For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Well, first off, the alumni for the local OU Sigma Alpha Epsilon chapter is hiring high-profile attorney Stephen Jones, who some might remember represented Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh and Oklahoma County Commissioner Brent Reinhart, and was a 1990 Republican opponent against then-Senator David Boren. Ryan, let's start with you. This seems to be about free speech rights. Does the SAE have a case?
You know, I think that traditionally protected speech is something you start off with the presumption that speech is protected, and then you work backwards from there. I think that while the expulsions of the two students do raise some serious questions about speech rights and whether or not that was protected speech and the expulsions violated the Constitution and the First Amendment, that doesn't really seem to be the case here because you've got Stephen Jones representing the alum of this fraternity. So you're looking at whether or not this entire fraternity can be punished. I think there are some more nuanced questions there about who owns the property, what the university can do with it. And you've also got the university. They've hired legal counsel and former judge Mike Burridge to come in and offer legal counsel on their behalf. So you've got these two heavyweights that I think are going to be talking. I don't think anyone here really wants this to be resolved in a courtroom, and I doubt that will happen. One of the unfortunate side effects of this, however, is that we're spending so much time talking about these First Amendment questions that were really manufactured whenever the university took its actions. And we're doing that instead of having the much more necessary and more difficult conversation about race on the University of Oklahoma campus. So my hope is that over the next few months and weeks, that as they resolve these questions about the First Amendment, that we can have that same legal heft and policy heft we send this issue devoted to the race issues on campus.
Neva.
Well, I think it is interesting that in the case of bringing in the attorneys, that one of the things that really struck me about Stephen Jones was his very first remarks. He said that really what they wanted to do was to pursue what he described as a non-legal, non-adversarial, and non-litigation solution, and that really he wanted to also ensure that the students' First Amendment rights of speech and association were protected. So from the outset, it was not throw the gauntlet down and we're ready to go to court and let's bring it on. It was more about how do we bring everyone into this process and try to do it in a way that begins to address the problems, but it's not just about filing a lawsuit. And on the flip side, I think that the university in bringing in former U.S. District Judge Mike Burridge, they really set the stage by saying that they wanted to not only go through an investigation and have a process where any actions taken that dealt with the student code, that they were done and included full due process. So I think, you know, both sides are trying to temper the kind of the heated atmosphere that all of this stems out of and really try to go through a thoughtful resolution that will take time, and certainly not everyone will be happy. But I think if they don't let outside instigators and agitators really exploit the process, they may be able to get something halfway seemingly good out of a very bad situation.
A state Senate committee narrowly passes a bill to ban teachers from paying union dues through their paychecks. The interesting moment in the panel comes from Oklahoma City Republican Ralph Shorty, who broke with his party in voting against the measure, saying he wasn't going to, quote, poke a teacher in the eye. Neva, does Senator Shorty have a point here?
I think he does. I think this was one of those interesting times where there was a lot of debate and a lot of things thrown out that really were confusing, a lot of it inaccurate. School teachers are district employees, not state employees, and we have an instance where really you have kind of two competing things going on. You have some Republicans who want to kind of use this as a way to go about hammering on unions, that collective bargain, as opposed to really addressing the issue that really was at hand, and that was about taking. Being able to earmark or take dues and a myriad of other things out of the cafeteria plan and their paychecks. So I think all of this got really confused. I think there was a kind of a back agenda. I mean, this is something that certainly Labor Commissioner Mark Costello and Tom Newell, who argued kind of along the lines of where the Labor Commissioner has been on this, is just hammer on the unions and try to score points when really that was not the issue at hand in the bill at all. all. And I think Ralph Shorty made his point. Look, this is one time where, you know, I had teachers out there every weekend and every day knocking doors in my last campaign, while my opponent probably was fully funded, you know, by at least max donations by the OEA and others, and that wasn't the point. So I thought he struck some good points, and I think this is a classic case of trying to mix a lot of different things together and confuse a lot of people and not really get to the heart of the issue.
Ryan,
I agree with a lot of that. And those folks, that those teachers that were out knocking doors in Senator Shorty's campaign, they weren't always knocking doors for him. Yeah, I think I bet a lot of those teachers were out knocking doors against him.
That's probably true, although he said 10 or 15 were probably knocking for
it. Yeah, and so. I'm sure that there were. But I think that, you know, Senator Shorty demonstrated he demonstrated something in this vote and in his comments that you don't often see out at the Capitol. And that's someone who recognizes a political opposition, respects them, and says that, you know, this isn't the way we're going to oppose one another.
Right.
Because you don't have to dig very deep in this bill to see, I think, what it's really about. And that's trying to disarm one of the most effective political entities in the state of Oklahoma, and that's the teachers lobby. And this is a direct attack on the teachers lobby by Representative Tom Newell, the labor commissioner, and to come out and say that it's about collective bargaining. And if it were, then it would be across the board. And,
right.
and this is really a slap in the face, as Senator Shorty said, I think, in other words, a real slap in the face,
a poke
in the eye
to
the teachers. And if you have 30,000 teachers that show up on the Capitol grounds lobbying for a particular measure, collectively bargaining with the state of Oklahoma, and then showing up in election cycles, you don't take your political opponents and disarm them. You engage them. And I think that if you're not willing to engage them and try to win the argument on substantive issues,
right.
I think it's disingenuous for folks like Representative Tom Newell then to come in and try to yank out their ability to fight.
It's interesting because Senator Shorty said that he could support an end to all of the state payroll deductions. He just didn't oppose this narrowly tailored ban that would just affect the two particular groups that were kind of targeted in this. And I think he's right. Now, the interesting thing is that would meet with a lot more resistance when you start talking about the checkoff with United Way and all of these other groups. And you have, frankly, the state agencies competing every year against each other to see how much money they can raise for these other groups that are earmarked. I mean, you know, folks have their deductions for coaches association dues or whatever it happens to be. So they've taken a very disingenuous approach to this whole debate.
And in a way, saying what a state worker does with his or her money, isn't that kind of interfering with what a person wants to do with their own money?
This is a benefit that the state of Oklahoma, like many employers in the private sector, offer their employees. Here's a way for you to very conveniently direct a portion of your salary that you've earned. You know, these aren't tax dollars anymore. They're your dollars. Mm-hmm. You're taking them and you want to direct them in a very convenient way to something that you care deeply about, whether it's United Way or OEA or what have you. I know at the ACLU, some of our members in the private sector, they have payroll deduction that automatically goes to the ACLU.
Or KOSU.
I mean, they could do it any other way, but this is just a benefit that the employer offers the employee, and to take it away for one entity, I think that, again, you don't have to look very far to see the politics behind this.
The Department of Corrections releases about 5,000 documents to the Tulsa World detailing the botched execution of Clayton Lockett. Ryan, were you surprised by reading any of this?
You know, I'd like to say that I'm not surprised by any of this anymore, but when you read these details and you just see how shockingly inept the government was at almost every step in this process, and then the steps to which they have taken to try to keep that ineptitude from the people of Oklahoma, I think that it's hard to say that it's not shocking. We've come to expect this, and maybe that we've come to expect it is shocking in and of itself. But I mean, in these documents, they demonstrate everything from medical ineptitude and trying to find a vein to insert an IV to political and legal ineptitude. And we have one instance now in these documents that have an assistant attorney general asking the warden to sign an affidavit that whenever the warden took it to the director of the Department of Corrections, said this would be considered falsifying a document in a court. Well, there's another word for falsifying sworn statement, and that's called perjury. And that we don't have the kind of outrage out at the Capitol where you have state entities doing everything they can to cover themselves up from potential liability, whether it's criminal or civil, all in an effort to execute somebody is crazy. And I think that if one of the things that I think gets lost in all of this are the DOC personnel and other volunteers that participate in these executions, the wear and tear on them, the psychological turmoil that they have to go through in all of this, and I think that gets lost in this as well.
Neva, this wasn't the first execution for Oklahoma. Is this kind of embarrassing that we had this kind of a problem after we've been doing executions for 30 years now?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a travesty to be in this place, but the upshot is we've got to figure out a way to move forward. And I think that's where combing through these tens of thousands of documents and looking at all of the problems that clearly kind of are glaring off of those pages, we have to find a way to sort through this and come to some resolution and move forward. I mean, we're not talking about that executions, that this eliminates the prospect of executions taking place in Oklahoma. What we've got to make sure of is that when we, as a state, if we are going to assume responsibility for carrying out those executions, that we have to do it in a way that passes not only a transparency test, but certainly does it in a way that I think all Oklahomans want to see.
Meanwhile, more than 11 months later, news outlets are still waiting on Governor Fallon to honor the open records request concerning the execution. Neva, for an administration that tries to push for transparency, is waiting about a year for documents a negative on Fallon's office?
Absolutely. And I think, when they talk about the fact that they only had one paralegal or something that was sorting through and trying to deal with this issue, I think it probably speaks to the issue of shouldn't we come up with a better plan inside the office to get the resources and personnel to be able to, in a very expeditious fashion, address this matter. So, yeah, I think it'd be hard to argue that there aren't problems with that.
Ryan, we've got multiple requests that are sitting out there for a year. I mean, part of that comes back to one paralegal being charged with this, but it's just not that paralegal. So you've got this one paralegal, and then you've got the general counsel's office, and then you've got counsel from all of the other agencies. I mean, this has really become a nightmare in terms of trying to get to the bottom of what's happening in our state agencies. And we're seeing a pattern. The pattern is this: the governor's office will be served with an open records request, and then they will drag their feet on it. And then you'll have litigation from Tulsa World and other entities in this case. And then right on the eve of a hearing to resolve this, they do a giant document dump. I think we're expecting around 60,000 pages now on the eve of a new hearing from a Tulsa World litigation, from litigation from Tulsa World. To me, this kind of brinksmanship really doesn't scream that we're trying to be transparent. What it says is we'll give you whatever you're asking for in a highly redacted form just before a deadline.
Finally, Lieutenant Governor Todd Lamb recently finished his fifth tour of all 77 counties. Late last week, the McAllister News Capital asked if he plans to run for governor in 4 years, and his basic answer was yes. Neva, is it too soon to start talking about 2018?
I don't think so. I mean, I think everyone is already speculating, anticipating, thinking about this. Certainly Todd Lamb sitting there with $1 million in his campaign account and someone who has proven to be not only a great vote getter but extremely popular, and someone who has been able to kind of parlay the office of lieutenant governor to be able to promote business and do a lot of the things that we've come to expect out of the person holding that office. So I think, Republicans certainly expect that he'll be one of the top contenders in 2018 for the governor's race. No one, I think, expects that it will not be without a primary. There are a lot of other folks that are certainly out there looking at it. So I don't think anyone's going to kind of clear the field years out anything like that. But Todd Lamb is a formidable political leader in the state of Oklahoma, and someone that I think, frankly, I thought it was refreshing when the McAllister newspaper asked the question and he didn't try to dance around it or be cute. He just said, yeah, it's at the front of my mind. Let's be straight. And so, I think that was very refreshing, and I applaud him for being direct and forthright about it.
Considering the hemming and haw we have on the presidential side, it's kind of nice.
Yeah, I appreciate his candor. I think that part of the dance that these folks go through whenever they're deciding when and how to announce their whether they're running or whether they're considering it. Part of the dance is that we're supposed to act like we don't want the office that they that everybody knows that they desperately want.
Caesar turned it down three
right.
times.
And so, you know, it's nice to see him depart from that dance and just say, okay, I'm thinking about this. Because if he'd said, I'm not thinking about it, everybody that is following what's probably going to happen.
And you get into the silly talk about, well, should someone be out there spending that much time out going across the state in all 77 counties and, you know, even the Democratic chair, you know, raising the issue of spending that money and doing that. That's the job of the lieutenant governor. And every person that's in a political office is out, in essence, while they may be doing things that have a public policy aspect or something else, they're still campaigning. I mean, any way you want to slice and dice it, they're still out meeting people, influencing what will long-term be part of the campaign process. So that it just doesn't hold water that somehow, if he were sitting in his office at the state capitol every day, people would be criticizing him for not being out talking to the people and trying to be involved in bringing business to Oklahoma or attracting industry or other things.
Right, and he's touring Oklahoma. He's not going out to some other state or even across, you know, to some other country.
So right. And even when he's done that, I mean, it's been private, you know, the Business Roundtable and other entities that have helped fund that. So it really hasn't been heavily on the backs of state taxpayers.
Actually, I'd prefer that the state pay for it than some private industry. I mean, I would, and, you know, in all candor, I think that I would much rather the state finance the duties of the lieutenant governor's office than to rely on some private entity. That, you know, frankly, I can't tell you a whole lot about, to fund these trips to the tune of five figures. I mean, to me, that's the bigger concern. But I agree with you. I mean, it's not too early to start talking about 2018. But yeah, Todd Lamb doesn't have a clear path to the nomination. I think that there's going to
30 years ago he might have had no primary.
But
in the Republican
Party, but that's not the case. I mean, it's going to be an incredibly competitive primary. And I think that, you know, Democrats, you know, are looking at 2018 as well. You look at the strong performance that Joe Dorman had in this last election in 2014, with very little money relative to the incumbent, and you know, not the same kind of ground game that he would have liked to have had. And I think that, you know, this is going to be a competitive gubernatorial race. You know, Todd Lamb may be the first name out there, but he's certainly not going to be the last.
Yeah, Ryan and Neva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.